Title that I'd like to look at tonight is Undomesticating God. I'd like to just start, I guess, with a little personal background and reflection on why would I be leading a retreat on wilderness and spirituality. I guess just to start by saying that I think, as you all know, I have done a fair amount of climbing. Ever since I was a kid, mountains seem to have some kind of affinity with mountains, even though no one in my family really did a lot of any backpacking, or certainly no climbing. I really wasn't exposed to that until I lived in Europe and I was 23 or 4 years old. But there was some kind of affinity there that drew me to that particular place. And as time over the last 10 years has gone on, I've done more and more skiing, ski mountaineering, climbing, and those kind of things, and always have felt like that in one sense of the word, the mountains were really at least one of my places. On the other hand, at the same time, until I came here, I spent about 8 years living in Boston, 5 of those years living in a low-income inner-city neighborhood. Part of that time doing work directly, a paid job in the neighborhood, doing community organizing out of a church and doing a lot of stuff with youth. Got very involved with housing issues in that particular area. And after the money for that particular job dried up, I still remained living there, and even though I was working in another place, I still remained pretty involved in neighborhood and city politics, and again, especially around some racism, economic justice, and housing issues. So I was one of these sort of strange people to the people in my neighborhood, which was just about equally split black, Hispanic, and white. They'd never seen an ice axe before, most of them, and so every weekend, or not every weekend, I wish every weekend, but as much as I could, I would load up my car on, you know, Friday night or early Saturday morning with all sorts of really quite strange equipment and take off to the mountains. So I led this life that was, and I guess I still do, and although the place where I now live has changed. It was very much in a what I would hope to have been a very creative tension. One of being very immersed and very concerned about and very committed to and very much in love with the city. I really loved the city in a lot of ways. And at the same time, for my own nurturing and my own enjoyment, trying to get to the mountains as much as I could and not ever feeling like I was getting there enough, which is one of the reasons why I decided that for a period of my life I needed to live in the mountains and not in the city. I think I'll end up back in the city. So somehow or another in my life, I started knowing and realizing that there was definitely a connection between a real passion and concern about economic justice and those kinds of things and the time that I spent in the mountains. And frankly, there wasn't a whole lot of resources or people to help me make sense out of that. I got a little frustrated, frankly, because, and this is oversimplifying things, but very often the people that were sort of into climbing or mountains, some did, but not a lot really had some of the same political and social concerns that I did. And on the other hand, the people that were, you know, doing work in the streets of Boston, a lot of them didn't have what I would consider a real appreciation for creation and a real sort of and being in touch with that. I can tell some wonderful stories though about taking inner city kids to the mountains, which I do quite often. So in trying to, I won't belabor this, but I mean, I'm sure a lot of you here probably have the same experience of trying to make sense out of that, trying to find out exactly what those connections were, so maybe I could enhance the connections and help each dimension of my life nurture the other. So I did start trying to do a little reading and try to pull together things that didn't necessarily directly address those issues, but try to make sense out of them. And then trying to apply that in some work I've done in outdoor ministries with both youth and adults in these kinds of programs. So that's, you know, where I come down, and a couple particular things that I find myself especially concerned about, or especially, I guess concerned is probably the right word, is that, for instance, I know Elmer Witt, our director, will be back on Sunday, has done a fair amount of stuff around the whole issues of creation theology, and he, in doing those, has often started his sessions by asking people where they feel like they most directly know God or feel God's presence. And it's probably skewed a little bit since he's doing sessions on nature and creation, but generally about 80% of people, he's said over the years, say that they most find that in nature. Well, that both really delights me. It also really disturbs me, frankly, because my sense is that if that's where people most know nature, and most of these people don't live out in some isolated little cabin somewhere, most of them live in the city, then what does that mean about the rest of their life? So I guess I'm not really interested in a spirituality of the wilderness that is isolated, that is sort of escapist, but my real concern is how can we make sense out of God's presence everywhere, and how can we really struggle with a sense of spirituality that where God is present and acting and nourishing in all parts of our lives and in all parts of our world. So what I really hope is that and what I've tried to struggle with over the last few years is a sense that wilderness, of exploring that, of being in it, of confronting it, can be something that not only helps us experience God in the wilderness, but also can enhance our sense of spirituality, our sense of a sacred or sacramental life everywhere. So that's my hope for both myself as well as for this weekend, that hopefully we can explore that in a way that might enhance that. So, what I want to do tonight is look at a sense of wilderness and what it is, and then spend most of the time looking at Exodus 16 and drawing out stuff from that, primarily looking at God and what we can learn about God and what we can learn about wilderness from that, and then coming back on Sunday and looking at the same stuff and a few other things and trying to figure out how the stuff we talk about tonight can then apply directly to us. And I should say that some of this is my own, I'll take responsibility for some of it. A lot of it also is sort of stimulated by thoughts from Walter Brueggemann and Dan Erlander, Walter Brueggemann's a theologian who's written a number of things on biblical theology. This is one of the ones which I'll talk about, which I'd really recommend, called The Land. And Dan Erlander is actually the campus pastor at Pacific Lutheran University and has a long tie and relationship with Hold, and has written some wonderful stuff on wilderness spirituality, as a matter of fact. So, let's start. Let's begin by just thinking about the term wilderness. And what I'd like to do is just get all of you to just brainstorm for a minute about what you think about. What do you think about when you hear the word wilderness? What are the characteristics of it? Essentially, what defines it? Or, you know, all those kinds of things. It doesn't have to be some neat definition, but we're just throwing up stuff. And then we'll talk a little bit more, just to sort of get us beginning. So,
wild.
What?
Wild.
That's a good start.
Yeah.
Remote.
Okay.
Solitude.
solitude and somebody else said something.
I don't know if there's one word, but not yet tampered with by man.
Okay.
Unspoiled.
Don't confuse me. All right.
Hostile.
Hostile, okay.
Uncomfortable.
Deserted.
Desolate.
I have one S or two? One.
Foreboding.
Okay.
Harmony.
What's that?
Harmony.
Harmony, okay.
Beauty.
Hungry.
Hungry. That was not a plant either for the tonight's Bible study, but anyway. Fits right in. Other stuff. What are some of the ways that you might try to define it? Or what would some of the things that you would use to define it, as well as in addition to these?
It's not made for me.
It's not made for
you. It's not made for me.
All right.
It's designed for me. I have to fit in. It doesn't fit me. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Okay. That's good. What other kind of things?
Sort of unowned.
Unowned?
Unowned.
All right. It
kind of goes off the same.
I don't know about this little group here in the corner of you guys.
I'm just interpreting what I can't read.
Okay.
Without boundaries.
Without boundaries?
Boundaryless. That's a lot.
Unbound, how's that?
There we go.
Okay.
I think about how intricate all the different parts of nature are, and how much when you look at them in up close, you can see so much in various forms of life. It's very intricate.
Okay. All right.
It's complex.
Okay. All right. Good.
Something, it seems that a number of these things get at the feeling I have, the scale being both immeasurably smaller and immeasurably larger. Again, not human scale, but infinite in both directions.
Huh. Okay.
Relative size is somehow an important aspect of my experience. That's right.
You were talking about like microscopic
right.
You know, complexities.
That's right, as well as vast, you know, processes in time and space that are far out of human scale.
Okay.
Both of them.
Mm. Anything else?
Vulnerable.
Vulnerable, okay. I assume you mean the wilderness is vulnerable, but whoever's in it. Or, no, maybe you are. No, I'm sorry.
The question was, what is wilderness for you? Or to me, wilderness is vulnerable.
Okay, the wilderness itself is vulnerable. Okay, all right.
It's also open.
Okay, all right.
It's something that we need to respect.
Okay.
One of the things that I'm always conscious about is the cycle of life and death, and the awareness of death in the wilderness.
The harsh laws of the survival of the fittest. Maybe that's pretty much the same, but
Okay, yeah. But
the harshness of
like the harshness of survival.
Yeah.
Could I should have asked this before. Does anybody by any chance write this down? Somebody could. I would like to hold on to this, so we might, I'm not sure, depending, might refer back to it. That would be helpful. Okay, well.
Robert Service got a nice poem on this.
Robert Service is probably the most read poet around campfires. But yeah.
About the wilderness.
Right.
In the end, the wilderness will win.
Barry, could I make a comment?
Sure.
It was fascinating to me to listen to this because it took 9 years to create the language of the Wilderness Act and pass it. And in that 9 years, the greatest difficulty that the people, and it was largely a Citizens Act, you only have to read it to realize Congress didn't read it or write it. And almost everything that's there is in the definition of wilderness in the Act. And you were terribly intuitive to one of the things that was they wanted to capture, and they had a very difficult time capturing, and that is that it is a place that man does not dominate. You said it was not made for me. That man is a visitor who shall not remain. Is how the Wilderness Act treated that, both that he does not dominate, both of those thoughts. Some of your words were really interesting to me. The word I was going to offer was home, but my perspective is very different than yours. But you should know that you have essentially captured the language that 8 years of discussion, debate, philosophic thought, captured, and if you have never read the Wilderness Act, it's one law worth reading, at least that first page.
I have it right
here,
too.
The word that's missing is untrammeled, and it captures a combination of five or six that are there, and there are many definitions of in people's minds of what was meant by trammeled. But trammeled essentially was meant by Sonheiser and others Miri and those that framed the words, was that it was without chains, control, unfettered, regulated, and there is a great dilemma for us to manage it and wrapped in that. But untrammeled is in the Wilderness Act and nowhere else I know. I've never seen the word used otherwise. It's really a created word. But an interesting perception that came from you to me.
Well, that's great, because one of the things I was going to do right now is read the definition in the Wilderness Act. And I want to come back to this thing about home. On Sunday, because one of my struggles is, on one hand, I think to really confront the experience of wilderness is to, in a one way, not feel at home there, but then in another way, it's a matter of how do we feel at home in a place where we can't really call home, and where we can't really call home, and I think when we talk about undomesticating ourselves. As we go along this weekend, I'd really like to come back to that. I just want to talk for a second about some of the things that are important in looking at wilderness in terms of our sort of contemporary understanding of it, and then we'll look at it in sort of a biblical understanding. I think we'll see that a lot of it's very much the same. But I think it would be interesting just to read the definition of wilderness in the Wilderness Act. I'm not going to talk about this in great detail. It was passed in 64 and is a really, really important piece of legislation. So if anybody does, as Dick was saying, I think if you want to read it, it'd be great. A wilderness in contrast with those areas where, by the way, this is obviously written in 64 before our consciousness about inclusive language came. And I tried to go through and change this, but it'd be very difficult. So if you'll bear with me, I'll just read it as it is. A wilderness in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. An area of wilderness is further defined to mean in this act an area of undeveloped federal land retaining its primeval character and influence without permanent improvements or human habitation, which is protected and managed so as to preserve its natural conditions which one generally appears to be affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the imprint of man's work substantially unnoticeable. Two, has outstanding opportunities for solitude, or a primitive and unconfined type of recreation. Three, has at least 5,000 acres of land. That's somewhat related to the unbounded degree. I mean, it does have boundaries, but at least there's a sense that it has to be somewhat large enough. And four, may also contain ecological, geological, or other features of scientific, educational, scenic, or historical value. But I think probably the things that are important in some ways in there are some of the stuff that Dick already talked about, that it's primarily in its natural state. There are no permanent inhabitants or permanent human-made structures. I would say too, there's essentially no motor vehicles. You travel only by walking for the most part, or skiing, whatever. And to add to that, I would also recommend a book called Wilderness in the American Mind by Roderick Nash, who is an historian and has done an incredible job of going through and just looking at the concept of wilderness in American mind, American history. And he starts the book off by just sort of looking at the meaning of the word wilderness and the etymology of it. Where does it come from, its roots? And essentially says that really the word wilderness only has meaning in civilization. In other words, if you have no experience of civilization, wilderness doesn't mean anything, because then wilderness is the natural state of things. But that the word comes from it has a history from German and Norse languages, where will, the word will, means uncontrollable or self-willed. And wild then comes from that, meaning unruly, or more almost confused and some stuff. And then the word dior, which is Old English, is added to that. And that refers to animals that are not controlled by humans. In other words, animals that are undomesticated, that are not domesticated animals. So if you sort of put all that together, basically wilderness, literally, in a really strict way, means a place where animals, untamed, undomesticated animals live. Or basically a place that is uncontrolled, which has its own will, in a sense. That is one of the aspects that, especially this, we're visitors, it's not designed for us, that I think we really need to look at. The history of the sort of Western concept of wilderness is probably, as most of us know, sort of runs from wilderness being something that was to be feared, almost, something that was to be opposed. It was something that was an obstacle to human development, so that the purpose of wilderness was basically to be there so we could dominate it and use it for our own purposes. Civilization was good, so wilderness was supposed to be subdued. And then you move on down the line where wilderness, I think for a lot of people, still has that connotation. For others, it became sort of a testing ground, or a place where we could become self-sufficient. We could sort of prove most of the time it was proving our manhood for males. And then becoming more of a place that has value in and of itself, where there's some kind of sense of connection and interdependence. And I guess what I would like to do is sort of take that and expand it now with a little bit of look at sort of the sacramental aspect of it as well. So let's look at Exodus 16. I brought out some extra Bibles, and let's see, does anybody else over here need one? Do you guys need Bibles back there? All right, I think they're all up here, Penny. I've got them all, except for the, why don't you just pass those back. Pass a couple of those back there. Okay. All right. What I before we actually start reading this, you know, I'll just sort of think most people probably have some understanding of the exodus of the Hebrew people out of Egypt. Just as sort of a quick summary, probably this is somewhere around the 1300s BCE, and around the reign of Ramesses II in Egypt. The Hebrew people had really were slaves. Moses comes along, confronts the Pharaoh, and they are able, with Yahweh's guidance and help, to leave Egypt. And now they find themselves in the wilderness. This is really where, this is sort of right after they've gotten across the Red Sea, and we pick up the story. So what I'd like to do is read this. And we will read through to, let's see, we'll skip verses 22 to 30. I'll just sort of summarize that. But if we could actually just get a few people to read a paragraph each. So if somebody would read 1 to 3 and somebody 4 to 8 and on down. That's at least the way the paragraphs are done in the Revised Standard Version. And just if we could read it slowly and everyone follow along, and then we'll talk about this a little bit. I'll just let anybody who would like to read start, if somebody doesn't mind.
They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger."
Okay, I'm going to make some editorial comments as we go along, if you don't mind. At the end of each paragraph. The first thing there is that the people are not expecting this. Okay, I mean, they think they're going to go straight to some promised land of milk and honey. I mean, that's been what sort of they've been told. So they've finally got, this has been incredible. I mean, you know, that they've been able to stand up to Pharaoh, and now here they are, just realizing that I'm missing half the people over here. And now they've gotten across the Red Sea in a pretty spectacular display of Yahweh's power here. And now all of a sudden they're in the middle of nowhere. It is just, and they say, "Why'd you bring us out here? We'd rather die in Egypt than go through this kind of stuff." All right. So that's the first thing. It's sort of an unexpected place of being in the wilderness to start with. This isn't where they plan to be. Somebody want to continue with verse 4?
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. For what are we that you murmur against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the fullest, because the Lord has heard your murmurings, which you murmur against him, what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord."
Okay. I'll just make a note to pay attention to verse 4, which says, "I will rain bread from heaven." We'll come back to that too, in terms of where the bread is coming from. Somebody continue with verse 9.
And Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings. And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness. And behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the murmurings of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am Lord your God.
Okay. I guess the another thing there I want to refer to is the glory of the Lord and also the cloud there, the sense of the cloud. We're going to come back to all this, but just as we go along, I just want to point out particular things we might need to refer back to. All right, the whole thing of the manna and quails. Verse 13.
In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay round about the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, every man of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take one omer apiece, according to the number of the persons whom each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning. And it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun blew hot, no.
Okay. The next part is basically, I'll just say, is when the sixth day came because of the Sabbath laws, and they weren't supposed to gather anything on the Sabbath, then they gathered twice as much. And even though during the week, if they took too much, it spoiled, when they gathered twice as much for the Sabbath, it remained fresh. And then we move down to verse 31, and I'll just say there that basically what's happening there is that they kept the one part of the manna, and that's where the sense of the Ark of the Covenant began, where they carried that around with them as a reminder that God provided for them in the wilderness. Okay. Let me just take a second and say a couple things. First of all, just to put this in the context of what follows. We talked about what came before. And in the chapter 17, you have a situation where at first they complained about not having any bread. They were provided with that. Then it was water. And that was provided by telling Moses that he should take a staff and hit the rock at Horeb, I think it is. Water came out of the rock. They also win a battle there because Moses stands on the hillside, and as long as he keeps his hand up, then Joshua is winning the battle, and his hands get tired and he starts dropping it, and then the other side would start winning. So finally he got some other people to help hold his hands up so that they won the battle. In Exodus 18, basically Moses chooses assistant leaders, and then you move into 19 where Yahweh says, essentially, I'm choosing you as a holy nation. And that's when the whole thing with Mount Sinai starts. Moses goes up on Mount Sinai. And then in Exodus 20 is when the Ten Commandments and the New Covenant is given. So I think it's really important to, because the covenant is really certainly a big part of what happens in the wilderness. So what I'd like to do now is just say, okay, what does this story, what are these verses, and in the context of what comes before and after this particular chapter, teach us about God? And just throw that up and let's talk about that for a little bit. What does it reveal about who God is?
Yeah, I should add that, I mean, half of the book of Numbers is this back and forth thing. I mean, God comes up with some scheme to provide them everything they want, and every time they turn around, it, this whole passage about would that we had died in Egypt and you bring us out here just comes up all the time. I mean, it's just like they're never satisfied. And it's like, this is the most God-forsaken place, you know, on earth, and why have you put in God-forsaken? That's, I guess that's an interesting used term to use. So right, very patient. If you read Numbers, it's even more so, more apparent. What other kinds of things do?
Origin of love.
Okay. Basically responds out of love, yeah. All right.
It's created.
Created, okay. Anything else to start with? Okay, well let me throw out some sort of maybe some ideas that might expand on a few of those and then maybe add a few others. First of all, just the whole idea that God is present. That's a surprise in itself for these people, really. Because for God to be present in the wilderness in this particular time, with these particular people, having, for the most part, the concepts of God that would have been the more popular ones at that time, that is a real surprise. That is totally unexpected. There, for most part, religions at that time would see God as having a particular place that God lived. So their sense was, okay, if we have to make some passage here, God either is in Egypt or maybe is going to end up in the promised land when we get there, and God is moving from one place to another. But in the wilderness, that's going to be sort of a no God and a no person land that we've just simply got to get through. So that's big news, that God is actually there at all. And then if we sort of expand on that a little bit and we look at sort of later in sort of the Old Testament story where you have the people have finally gotten into the land of Canaan and there's the whole sort of discussion about whether or not there's going to be a temple or not. I mean, part of that is that God says, no, I don't need a home. This is a really new concept of who God is. God doesn't have a home. The only thing that God for the people in the desert was in a tent, which could be picked up and moved. Or that was at least the focal point. But God wasn't there. Where is God? How is God seen or represented in this particular passage? In the cloud. So God's present, but God isn't completely seen. So that there's a sense there in the cloud that God is both transcendent but also very much in people's midst. I think sort of in relation to that then that you can move on and say that, I mean, who in this story is in control? I mean, that's pretty obvious. And I think that's the major issue as we come down here. Who is in control? It's not the people. It's not Moses. I mean, what does Moses say here when the people are murmuring? He says, I mean, this whole thing between verse 6 to verse 8 is, hey, why are you murmuring against me? I don't have anything to do with this. This is God's problem, not mine. You know, he brought us here. It's because the Lord has heard your murmurings. That I think is what happens in the wilderness that often doesn't happen in other places, is the recognition that God is in control, the people aren't. I mean, the fact was today that it was real clear that we got you all up here, but
it was real clear yesterday that, you know, we were totally dependent on what happened on the road as far as avalanches and snow conditions and all that. You know, we have the technology to do a few things here and there, although Holden has our, definitely have our limitations, and, you know, who knows what's going to break down. It's remarkable that Chris Borges keeps the stuff running that he does. But I think that there's a way in which we don't have mediated for us our experience in the wilderness that we do in other places. Okay, God is the provider. Somebody mentioned that. Certainly God is known, and God is wants to be known. And how is God known? God is known as God provides. God is known in the act of responding, of loving, of providing. And God transforms the wilderness. I want to get in a minute then to what do we look at in terms of wilderness. The wilderness, you know, we have a relatively, although the list up here had hostile in it, it had being uncomfortable. By and large, I think most of us who would come to a retreat on wilderness and spirituality have a fairly positive attitude towards wilderness. These people didn't. I mean, this was a very barren place, and it's not the same as here. You don't have all this lush green growth and beautiful snow and mountains, and this is a desert. And in fact, the Hebrew word for wilderness is it's often translated either desert or wilderness, sort of back and forth. But what is expected to be a place of barrenness turns out to be a place of nourishment. Again, God acts, and I guess that's another point, is that God acts in very unexpected ways. Not only is God in control, God is uncontrollable and unpredictable. Which I don't think we usually think about. At least I don't. Huh?
I think that's been a hang-up for our Western churches.
I think you're right.
And that's why liberation theology is
That's right. We tend to want to tame God, and I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second. But again, God acts in unexpected ways and is not controllable and is not predictable. And transforms a place of barrenness into a place of nourishment and abundance. Essentially, what the people realize is that it's not the land that they are promised, that they're looking for, that they're dependent on for nourishment, that it's God. That even though maybe when they finally get into the land, the promised land, and that's where their nourishment comes from, that essentially it's still God who's providing that. And what happens in the whole history of Israel, essentially, is that they screw up because they misinterpret that. They forget the wilderness story. They forget the manna story. They forget where the nourishment comes from. And they start thinking with their sense of ownership and kingship and putting God in the temple, that they can provide their own sense of security, and they skew and pervert the sense, the source of the nourishment itself. And I guess finally I just want to say in this that I think in this story, and especially if you look at some of the Numbers passages related to the same thing, and I think when you look at on this on Mount Sinai and all of that stuff around that, or if you look at the article that I gave you about taking off your shoes of people. We were going to look at that this afternoon. We'll look at that tomorrow. But the whole story of Moses on the mountain there when he's called to his ministry of the burning bush and all that. God is pretty scary sometimes. And I told Elaine I was going to quote her. Elaine and Clint are pretty good friends of mine. And about a year and a half ago, I'm sure she had no idea that on the back of a Kennedale Methodist Church bulletin, I have notes from a sermon that she preached on Christian education. But one of the things that she said was is that one of the problems with our Christian education programs is that we almost do everything we can to avoid really coming face to face with God. Because it's too scary.
Because to come face to face with God is not easy stuff. Because what happens if we come face to face with God?
We have to come to a decision.
To come to a decision, we have to confront the fact that we have to change our expectations, and we have to ourselves change. And that's sometimes just too scary to deal with. So I think out of this, there's a sense that I would say that God and wilderness really belong together. That as God transforms the wilderness almost provides the peculiar way or the peculiar mode in which God is present. That it is in fact the wilderness where God is really present. And I, not to deny it's not present elsewhere, because I already said I'm concerned about that. But that confronting God in the wilderness requires of us, is what I've just said, a really new understanding of what God is, or a different understanding of what God is. And it's not the same kind of understanding of God if we confront God only in our comfortable, secure homes. And that's really what I want to try to deal with as we go along in different ways. If we really fully confront wilderness, and we look in this story, and we're going to come back to this, by the way, and look really a lot more at the manna stuff when it talks about us. But there is a sense here that, you know, God is, God becomes more a part of those Israelites' lives who are willing to confront the idea of wilderness and are willing to accept the experience of wilderness and not constantly be looking towards something else, but are willing to deal with the wilderness on its own terms. And I would encourage you to read further in Exodus as well as that. Now, what my premise is that we, like the people in Israel and the Hebrew people moving into the Promised Land, have lost our memory of wilderness, of the wilderness experience, of the wilderness story, and that we have domesticated God, essentially. That we have, like they have, tried to do, was put God in the temple. And that we, and I'm obviously talking about in general terms here, have lost that memory, don't reclaim that memory, and don't really understand what it means to confront God face to face in the wilderness. So what I'd like to do now for a few minutes is just ask you, what are the ways, if you agree with that, and we can talk about that in a minute, what are the ways that we domesticate God? Yes?
Just by always wanting control ourselves instead of kind of letting go and putting some trust in God.
Okay.
And utilizing our faith.
What are some of the ways that we might do that?
Examples of that.
Yeah, Jerry?
You can only encounter God on Sunday in the church.
Okay. Yeah, we don't apply God, excuse me, to a lot of different aspects of our lives, right?
By spending so much time in a church, in the building, having all your church activities on the campus.
Okay.
Instead of reaching out, like coming to Holden,
right,
or just taking a group outside. Away from that sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any kind of formal worship isn't necessarily bad, but it does domesticate, whether the form is the form of a building or the form of a liturgy or spoken, repeated spoken words or on a schedule at a time, sort of misses that wild aspect of God, which is without form.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of void and chaotic. More powerful than
okay. Yeah.
Otherworldly theology can kind of keep us from expecting God to do anything now. So wait for it all to happen some other time.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's almost like instead of restricting what you think is not restricting God, but making God so otherworldly, what you do really still is restrict God.
We had this incredible conversation with the kind of a militant Zen Buddhist who runs this pizza shop in Roswell. How does this work? I know this kind of Zen. Maybe I have to get back to this. Yeah, I know you don't. I had a thread. It was never mind.
Well, if you figure out the thread, Clint.
Otherworldly theology. Yeah, this whole thing about how, what we need is a revolution, but it's got to be a mental revolution. You know, we have all these apparent dualisms and on and on. And it was really weird because this guy was talking tough, but nothing happened. And it was a way of keeping the transformation of encountering God sort of out of anything here. Yeah.
Okay.
So much of prayer is an attempt to impose our will on God.
That is a big one for me. I've started talking about how we use God as a genie. That when people want to pray for this to happen, I mean, I get really disturbed when people pray to find their car keys and stuff like that. I think we do. We use God as this little genie that's going to run around and do things for us. And I think that's really domesticating. It's like a pet. You know, go get my slippers and bring them to me. I think that's really good. Other ways which we domesticate God.
I think another one is we have conceptualized a defined visual image of God. He is a man with long hair sitting on a throne, and I have this image in my mind. I guess it's been so ingrained from my childhood, because this is where it probably started, and put him in a human form for one thing, and a sex form, a gender form.
Good. What about politics? How do we, in the United States, domesticate God in our politics?
Well, he's behind our cars.
Oh, yeah. He always seems to be, too.
I didn't catch it. Behind our
cause. Our cause.
Whatever our cause might be.
Yeah.
It's right.
We always, Ronald Reagan refers to God in just about every political speech he makes. Just about everyone. And there's a way in which we invoke God to support, protect our own policies, our own ideologies, our own lifestyle. Martyr?
I think it's interesting too that our coin within God we trust. And you know, the pretty vague actually.
That's right.
He also said an education of success with godliness. That if that because America is successful, that's
a sign of God's presence. That's right. In this thought about wilderness, we do it with word substitution. Nature. Now, if nature is not equate to God, then I don't quite understand what's going on out there. And we do. We feel very comfortable to refer to nature and natural process and so on and not attribute that to God, which in fact is nature, as I see the construction of things.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a real good point. It's another way of sort of limiting God to one image.
Building an amusement park.
Right. Jim and Tammy Baker, right, in their amusement park for God. That's true. Yeah.
I never really thought of it before, but strangely, we also give gender to nature. Mother nature.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Mother Earth.
Well, I think other ways that we do it, I will take a risk here. I know there are a couple of clergy in the room, but I really think that some of the ways we domesticate God by the distinction that we make between clergy and laity, essentially, that God sometimes that we sort of package God primarily with the clergy, and so the laity have to sort of go through the clergy to get to God. And I don't think that theologically, you know, we wouldn't say that, because most of us here are, I don't know. I'd say most of us probably theologically wouldn't say that. We would say, yeah, we believe in the priesthood of all believers. But in reality, in the way we act, that's really what we do. So we've again sort of found, we've domesticated the representatives of God, which in a way domesticates God.
I was in a
You got excited about
I did.
Something.
I was in a discussion group with Alice Walker. This comes to me every once in a while, and I need this admonition, I think. Shortly after The Color Purple had been made into a movie, and one of the questions I asked in the discussion was, did she think that there was any hope for the redemption of the church? She's really down on the church. And her response was kind of not helpful in some way, in direct response to the question, but her response was helpful to me, because she said, well, most ministers I know keep people away from God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's really something to that. You know, there is we tend to be distrustful of people's kind of natural spiritual tendencies. Yeah. Make sure they get channeled right.
That's right. Well, I'm guilty. I'm not ordained, but I'm guilty of the same thing. I think that some of the ways in which the wilderness philosophy that we talked about before, I mean, we can rape the environment because God gave it to us to dominate. I think that's a one way. We use God at football games. We use God at all sorts of public events. You have to start them with the prayer. So you sort of domesticate God by making God, again, this little pet that you bring in for your little events. And we also use God to support our own sort of limited judgments about people, whether they don't believe the same way we are, that we do, or whatever. And also, I think we domesticate God by acting as though we know how God thinks. obviously, or either by people who will tell us that they just had a vision from God, and I'm not going to try to say that no one has visions from God, but there's a lot of them out there that I don't believe in. Like, you know, 400-foot Jesus is telling you to build hospitals and things like that. What I think we do put our faith in, we domesticate God by having God sort of in these little pockets of our lives. And then we really put our trust in sort of building up our lives materially. We put our hope and our trust in particular kinds of jobs. I'm disturbed, probably not, I don't know, people here are probably particularly into this, but I don't know, I am disturbed personally, if somebody wants to talk about this, we can, about the way and the number of Christians who are pulled into some of the human potential movement groups, like EST. And I think there's some real good stuff in that, but I also think that ultimately, and in the extreme of that, there's a sense that we put our faith in ourselves, that the human potential is such that we can do anything we want to as long as we put our mind to it. Astrology is another one. And I really get into some really interesting conversations with people. There may be some basis for astrology, but I cannot accept the fact that that is going to determine our lives and decisions. It's a sense of fatalism that, for me, essentially wants to put our security in something that's sort of preordained and fated. And so there's not that sense of God being sort of unpredictable, uncontrolled, wild. So essentially saying that we cannot be fully human and be who we are if we don't let God be who God is. And that we have got to undomesticate our view of God. And I don't think it's a matter of undomesticating God. I don't think God needs to be undomesticated, but it's our view of God. And really, essentially, reclaiming the wilderness story. Both experientially, which is part of what we're doing here, as well as in our own sort of way of thinking, as well as our own prayer life, theological life, and whatever. Let me just do one more quick section, and then we'll just take a quick break, or really just get in small groups for a minute, and we'll be well within our time, I think. If we look at Exodus 16, we've talked about what it teaches us about God. The other question then for tonight is, what does it teach us about wilderness? And essentially all this stuff sort of comes out together, and we've already talked about that. So let me just real quickly just say that I think it says that wilderness is wild, but it's not wasteland. Which I think, I mean, essentially the Hebrew people saw the desert as wasteland. What they found out was that it wasn't, that there was nourishment there. That the wilderness is a place that where there's unexpected nourishment. That it's a place of promise and gift. It's a place where God is in control, as God is in control everywhere. And it's a passage. And that's something that I want to come back to again. I keep saying we're going to come back to all this stuff. It's probably going to take about a 5-hour session to come to all this stuff anyway. So, what I'd like to do now is take most essentially the rest of the time, which is about 20 minutes, and just have a chance to talk about this. I know I've been talking a lot, and the rest of the sessions won't have quite as much of my talking, I hope. But a lot of you contributed quite a bit. But I'd like to just take a few minutes and maybe get in groups of like 5 or 6 and just talk for a few minutes about whether this kind of stuff that we've been talking about tonight makes any sense at all in your experience. Maybe you disagree with it. Maybe the perception doesn't quite make it, or you find some real holes in it. But I guess primarily if that fits your experience of the wilderness and also other aspects of your life, and if so, how so, if not, how not. And just let us get back together for a few minutes at the end and talk about that. So if people want to get up and go get a cup of tea before you sit down, I don't want to take a major break, but if you could just, probably the best way is just to get in, say, groups of 5 around where you're sitting. We'll talk about that, and we'll come back and wrap it up and just say, why don't we say 15 minutes from now we'll get back together. Well, let's say 12 minutes.
Or in some odd You're a Colleen.
Okay.
The flip side here, I mean, have a lot of people
They have the ability to find a way out. And essentially help guide them in themselves and find a way out of this situation, and maybe other situations too. Maybe they're allowing themselves to be dominated by another.
I think
I think there's a lot of times that are not using this
to the expectation fulfillment of your request.
But the concern of all the
So I'm disagreeing with you. I consider that to be part of human potential.
I'd love to.
Death is an end. Christianity believes it's a beginning.
It only seems to be that man. There's only one element of the universe.
It's not where we're going to know it.
I don't believe in the body. Christian, I'm going to demonstrate to you that the Christian, that death is the beginning of life. This is also true.
I feel very sorry. I'm not bringing my natural self.
That's a resurrection.
There's something else you said about your use of the word resource. It gets back to that. A resource is a purely economic concept. That is a flat out production. One way that you can define wilderness is it is a place that's not a resource. It's not chopped up to be harvested, husbanded, cultivated, whatever it is outside of all that production.
We're marvelous distinction. I know that the wilderness is
affairs of wilderness. Is a
well,
yeah,
no, but
yeah.
I think it does for very much the reason that you make.
Maybe a spiritual resource.
Well, but you see, I think because you're right, resources is really an expression of a value system by mankind. It's worth something, it's good for something. It's resource. And people that are very creative and resourceful can get along. I think that Congress decided to, was persuaded by the citizens who are to declare a resource because we have that respect for that work and what it represents.
Yeah.
And it was, well, it is not a wasted piece of land. You hear, of course, the people that decry the creation of wilderness.
Yeah,
as being set aside, locked up. Okay,
yeah,
locked up means locked up from extraction, from resource extraction. And so I think really the Congress was persuaded of those of us that work on language.
I don't want
to call it a resource, so that we give it
just
a
like
creative
challenge,
human value.
Yeah, so you're,
I really haven't thought
and that's a kind of debased definition. I mean, talking about wilderness in terms of character transformation in the Exodus story, we know that that's a far more cosmic process than resource extraction, but to be able to express in terms of secular, what you have to talk about kind of resource is kind of the highest compliment.
So contrary to those ways,
yeah, that's right, waste and resource all part of human.
Not useful.
Yeah.
What is it?
Doesn't produce anything for the treasure.
Yeah, what would be the direct
association? How can we take God
for our liability? It would be something that made you poorer because you had it.
And that's the whole of the meant to be. I think
there's no resource.
The thing that struck me from that God Exodus story there was that it involved a loss of identity. The Hebrew people really, I mean, they had some role in Egypt that knew what it was, and they escaped because it was like what they found out is they didn't know what they were anymore. They had no definition whatsoever. And the story is about how they worked out, they went to the wilderness, and they worked out a new character, a new identity by working out a relationship with the enemy. Infinitely larger and smaller, and longer and shorter kind of an environment they were in is what helped them define a new character. So it seems to me that somehow it's a loss of identity and wilderness. And the derivation of who and what you are.
Don't even know that this kind of
dialogue with God is an important part of what wilderness is. A place where that process goes on.
But I think you
can develop a wilderness
of the sense that they have God lived in place.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the name
because I think we still have to.
You ever get a chance to help with it?
See, that's why I think the whole day of wilderness is home, because that really is where I feel like I belong.
And
I
was going to come home.
It's Luther, the brotherhood.
Church, you know, it's not possible. It's not like the other words of the rough that I understand. It wouldn't be a place you had to write.
Fighting the right guy out there.
Some people wait for knowledge.
That's very important.
You know, the risk.
Self-sufficiency. So if you're not in charge. And so I think that male tie, an exodus present, oh, it needs change. I think we still place God in place.
Because one, we were talking about how we can work in the church and formal worship. You know, I think it would be just the same thing, but only saying God in relationship.
I want the connection
in the sort of
God, the interconnected
nature
with all of us.
Which leaves God out of
it. Develop it, create it. Have a dualism, place God apart instead of
that dualism. That dualism existed with Indians, which is really associated with what we're talking about. But they also had duality because they worshiped, the Yakimas worshiped the Manas. And so they had a place where God resided. Almost all Indian religions have places where God resided, where God was
collected.
And so there's probably nothing wrong with the duality if it's dual.
If we understand that as being dual.
Yeah, see,
I think they're outside. They're outside. You find God in the church on Sunday, then you got a problem.
What you say is that God is not present in the
world.
No, God has showed up. We expect God. God's in the city. I think it's okay to identify set aside places where you can, even just by mutual agreement, we all agree that you can, that's God's place. That's what a sanctuary is. That's what Mount Adams is. In fact, that's what the wilderness area is. The wilderness, say so. In this country, the wilderness area. Whatever. That's what the wilderness is. That's where they could.
There is no wilderness area. We didn't make
a lot of expectations.
We just put boundaries around
everything. You've got a civilized area, but you don't have a wilderness.
What were you saying? You're saying something about the wilderness area.
I was thinking setting aside a place for God, whether it's Mount Adams or a church, is all right. So you don't limit God to that place. And then I was sort of going on to that, saying, in a way, maybe though we can't admit it, in a secular nation, that's what the wilderness is. We do set up laws and say, this area is the wilderness, and that is kind of a set aside place.
It's only because it's essential to do so.
That's right.
Because we have that ethic. Indians, I participated in the Vision Quest with the Yakimas and the reason they select the place for a vision is that it was inspirational. Okay, that's one of the reasons we build churches, and to inspire. People's lives collecting to build a single building. Really understand, inspiration. But Indians do that the same thing. So again, it's fine with the sense that God is everywhere. All natural things are expressions of God. They still find their places of inspiration.
I think as people we tend to create those places, whether we know it or not.
It crushes my mad rush to whatever it is I'm doing instead of some wonderful opportunity.
Somewhere I like to go across the concept that a lot of people want to sail over the sea.
I expected that
spending a lot of time in the finding there with sort of small household holy objects and important things that are there. a rock and jar.
That's an interesting answer. My mother was a bird out of creation. He had a little crucifix. Simulation of the various. It's a simulation of the shrines that you see everywhere in the trails and in the Alps. Crucifixes everywhere. They've just been established over
Well, we could get that together, and then you can continue over some popcorn and juice. We want to get back together just for a minute to close, and I hope that people will continue the conversation, and throughout, I hope that this has given some things to at least chew on. Are there any particular strongly felt or insightful things that came out of the discussion that people want to talk about in the whole group? Or
I think we have one that is so very directly related, you know, to the theme of the retreat. We got into a discussion here that when my friend raised the point that wilderness, one thing wilderness was a resource. And in the sense that man sees resource as a usable and extractable, valuable thing, the act says that wilderness is a resource. And so I searched my mind on because I fundamentally agree with it, but I searched my mind on why we said that. And where the source of those words in those of us participated in the construction of language. And I think that came from the agency. One of the ways that we could ensure ourselves that the managers, the Forest Service, of the wilderness would respect it is to call it a resource, because it's a powerful, powerful word in our agency, ANG Land Managing Agency. And so, you know, the resource of wildlife, of recreation, of timber. And so we declared that through Congress, the law of the United States, that it is a resource. To give it co-equal value with those things in our lexicon of values, which have, you know, really useful things we can use. And indeed, it probably is not a resource. Interesting valuation.
And I'll add to that, I just wrote a note. One, I have a real pet peeve about making it a spiritual resource, too.
Yeah.
It's a real strange kind of thing, because I think that it is a resource in the sense that when I really do believe that experiences in the wilderness are spiritually enhancing and growing, but I want to see the wilderness as in a value in and of itself, not to be there just so that we can go off and have spiritual experiences. I don't know if I make any sense. There's a real paradox there, but that's the same kind
of
thing.
Resource,
I don't want to turn it into a resource. Yeah.
It's so closely tied to human utility and production.
Yeah. Exploitation.
Exploitation, extraction.
Right.
So we're going to extract a little inspiration from the old resource. You know, which is different from what you're saying. It's, you know, it's a wild thing. It's outside of us. It's beyond us. It's on its own terms, and something happens to us if we go there.
But we chose the word to justify the act.
Yeah.
Which puts an interesting perspective on things like the climbing accident on Mount Hood that killed all the high school kids.
Yeah.
It was not an accident.
Yeah.
climbing screw up.
I mean, we take kids on outings to, I mean, I think it's a very complex situation. I think it's an important.
Yeah, it is. I have a lot of, we can, well, sometime we, maybe we, people who are interested should get together and talk about outdoor ministries. I'm sure other people besides myself have real strong opinions about that. You were going to say something, though?
I was just going to say, just musing on the word resources, and some folks might misinterpret that to mean storehouse, and so they'll say, you know, we're storing all this stuff up, and one of these days we'll get our hands on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a great way to do.
Yeah.
Yes, that, it, that yeah. What we did is in fact, bank the resources for a future generation that would be more enlightened and see the other values.
Hold on to that concept of storing too, because I mean the manna story is very clear. You can't store it up. And
yeah,
again,
right.
We have a list of about 35 things now that we're going to come back to on Sunday. That's one of the things in there.
That's another word I would have offered for our words up there was in my mind, but I was more interested in how you perceive wilderness, but change. It's the very first word after home that came to my mind is in home, the very personal relationship, but change. And I'm going to demonstrate a little bit in a couple of slides tomorrow night the fact that there is a human perception that natural things don't change. Like those two trees out there are exactly the same as they were when you first came to the village. In fact, there's one tree, it's a white pine at the rear of this building up here, that was that high the first time I came, and it's now 15 feet above. And if you want me to read a little land with you, I'll read that tree right back to the ground with you tomorrow. But that tree was that big when the village started, but there will be people that come to this village year after year that swear it's always been that big. So that, because change is very, very slow, sometimes very dramatic other times, Mount St. Helens being one, we tend not to perceive change. Mm-hmm. The change is happening just absolutely constantly, everywhere up there.
Well, if we can continue.
Our group kind of was getting into a more personal side of wilderness and how each of us can experience that, given that wilderness is an image for a way to get closer to God or a way to experience God. We kind of talked about how any particular person creates that wilderness within themselves, whether it's an experience of coming to a place like this, or if you're in the midst of a city, or if you're in Calcutta, India, or have never been out of the city in your life, where and how you create a source of wilderness within yourself. And we also talked about maybe in prayer, true prayer to God is maybe creating that sense of wilderness, that sense of expandedness, of vastness, of unbounded unlimitedness, that we lift ourselves up to God, that we are open ourselves to God in the kind of wilderness that we create within ourselves.
That one must remove oneself from inside of us in order to allow God to come in.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's our handicap. We're so full of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We don't empty ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Surrender.
Of ourselves.
That's in the Exodus story too, where the Hebrew people lost identity. Their fundamental experience of the wilderness is, who am I, where am I, and what am I doing here?
You know,
they weren't slaves anymore. They would rather be slaves than redefine themselves in relation to and in dialogue with the infinite God.
The sense of being uprooted to become rerooted.
Yeah.
Well, this is perfect, because what I'd hoped was that this would lead us into thinking about exactly what we're now talking about. I can say that because it sounds like I really knew what I was doing. And no, but that we can now take what we are talking about. In other words, if we have to confront God in a different way, or at least in some different ways, then what does that do about, what does that say about how we have to deal with ourselves? And what are some of the things like storing things and letting go, and you were saying sort of opening our, how did you say it, pouring out ourselves, the re-identification, the change stuff, all of that kind of thing, I think is leads right out of some of the stuff we've talked about. And so that we really have to then deal with who we are in the context of the wilderness too.